Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you. Welcome to DW's Africa Link program. I'm Isaac Mugabe in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, African leaders have joined their European counterparts in condemning the Brussels attacks that left at least 30 people dead. A resident tells us how Africans living in Brussels are trying to overcome the threat posed by terrorists and continue with their daily lives.
That's, I think, how you answer to terror, is by trying to the maximum to live your life as free as possible.
Under the shadow of an expanding civil conflict, South Sudan's national soccer team, the Bright Stars, are bracing for a showdown against Benin this afternoon in the capital, Juba. The players are pushing for a win, which would bring them close to qualifying for the Africa Cup of Nations tournament.
Really, it's going to be an important match for us and all of the people in the Republic of South Sudan.
Also in the program, authorities in Zambia have set minimum education requirements for those seeking political office, making many wishing to contest as local councillors ineligible. Stay tuned.
Top story.
First, let's take you to Brussels, where deadly terrorist attacks on Tuesday left at least 30 people dead and hundreds injured. World leaders, including Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari, have condemned the attacks. Buhari, in a post on his Facebook page, said that the events in Brussels reinforced the need for greater international cooperation to effectively confront and destroy global terrorism. Nigeria was ranked third in 2015 on the Global Terrorism Index for countries most affected by terror attacks. The Matonge district of Brussels is home to many Africans, especially those from the Democratic Republic of Congo, who have turned it into a popular business hub. In the wake of the attacks, African businesses have also been affected. I spoke to Nganji Mutiri, a Congolese resident of Matonge, and asked him how the residents were reacting to the attacks.
So far, most people I spoke to who are in the center, they are either staying in the offices, or they are invited to stay at home or go back home, actually. As you may know, it's very hard. The lines are jammed, and they advise people to send either SMSs or check on the social network. So that's what we are all doing with friends right now. So it's very difficult to speak live and direct to family members who are in the center of the city right now. We just send each other SMSs.
In your opinion, in case this shutdown continues for days, how is it likely to affect the African community who do business in Brussels, in Saint-Vitien and elsewhere?
Personally, I don't think that it will affect the African community and businesses more than the other businesses. You know, as we've seen in Paris or some other cities under attack in Africa, it's always about the people. If people are afraid to go out and mind their own business and keep buying or visiting cultural places, it's true that there'll be less traffic, less said that. So I think it's going to be very important to see how we react, whether it's by solidarity, whether it's just like getting over the first shock, which is always very tragic and emotional, and try to do like some of my friends. They try, once they had the news about their family members that they are safe, we are trying to cope with the situation by keep on doing what we do. So I'm expecting shops in Matonge to be open now and see in a very shy way people starting to come back to their habits. I think it's really similar to how it affects the other communities as well. I think shops will be open, and it's about us to go there and support, trying to slowly continue with enjoying life, if I can say, even if it's a tragic day. But that's, I think, how you answer to terror, is by trying to the maximum to live your life as free as possible.
I was speaking to Nganji Mutiri, a Congolese resident of Brussels.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
to South Sudan now, where 21 generals from rebel leader Riek Machar's camp were expected to arrive in Juba on Monday ahead of Machar's arrival, but were threatened with imminent arrest by authorities. It seems that no solution to the conflict in South Sudan is materializing, as both the government and rebels have on numerous occasions backtracked on their promises to end the violence. Before we came on air, I spoke to Peter Schumann, former director of the UN mission in Sudan, and I started by asking him for a brief overview of the political stalemate in Juba.
You can always use an administrative logistic argument as an excuse if you don't want to move forward in the implementation of a political idea, being to form this interim government. Both sides have no trust in this interim government. We have an agreement which is constantly dishonored because we do not have a very clear conviction on both sides that a political solution is possible, but they are still pursuing the military way.
South Sudan's Foreign Minister Barnaba Marian Benjamin said his government had begun paying the bills after the US, the United Kingdom, right, and Norway stopped paying the bills, and said that his government is also going to stop paying the bills. Yeah. Do we know why the three countries, the Troika, that is the US, the UK, and Norway, in the first place, stopped paying these bills?
I can only speculate because they have also shown in other areas that they are becoming increasingly not only annoyed, but they are becoming increasingly frustrated, and they do not have faith that the political solution is really moving forward. So I think they're becoming very wary about this, and they don't want to invest any further. In my analysis, I think they have made mistakes before, and they are now withdrawing on this administrative issues. They should have been a lot tougher with the parties, with the SPLM in opposition and the government, in really, you know, pushing a political solution forward. And, you know, there are too many examples where, in the end, the international community, be it the Troika, be it the friends, then in the end always caved in and they said, okay, fine, we will continue. To me, this is unacceptable, the documented killing, mass killing of people, naming of the perpetrators, and then the Security Council expresses deep alarm. This is a declaration of bankruptcy of the Security Council.
What do you think will happen next in case the government stops paying the hotel bills of Riek Machar's advance team?
You were referring to the statement from the Minister of Foreign Affairs.
Yes.
There was also a news item that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is considering to close down a number of embassies because they have a severe financial problem. Oh. So it seems that the government of South Sudan is having their back to the wall, and they lack the financial resources to continue maintaining sort of the minimum level of international representation or paying hotel bills or whatever, no? And that's sort of an additional factor which makes it very, very, well, difficult to see a change. I think what we have witnessed in Sudan, South Sudan, over the last couple of years and years and years, no? Famine, violence against civilian population, robbery of public property, this will simply continue. I don't see an end to this.
Peter Schumann, former director of the UN mission in Sudan. On a positive note, South Sudan's national soccer team, the Bright Stars, are bracing for a showdown against Benin this afternoon in the capital, Juba. The team's coach says that extensive preparations have been going well over the past 2 weeks, and his team is determined to secure the 3 points and a possible place at the African Cup of Nations tournament. Wake Simon Wudu reports from the capital, Juba.
That is Bilal Felix Komuyangi, the interim head coach of the South Sudan's national football team, the Bright Stars, preparing his players for this week's match against Benin. South Sudan will face Benin on Wednesday in the capital, Juba, as part of qualifications for the 2017 African Cup of Nations. Komoyangi says his team is determined to secure 3 more points on top of its win last year against Equatorial Guinea.
Really, it's going to be an important match for us and all of the people in the Republic of South Sudan, because you know this game is very important as we are a country which has only, let us say, 5 years fully. We need also to show to people that we have football. So that also we need to go and compete in African Cup of Nations.
While he is hopeful of winning, Komoyangi admits it's going to be a tough game.
Benin is not a simple team because most of the players are playing in Europe. For us, we have as well as a good number of local players, and then some players we have from outside also. They are coming to compete. They need to come and play because they need to expose themselves also outside, so that people outside may know that we have some talented players in South Sudan.
Fighting between government forces and rebels in South Sudan broke out in late December 2013, sending the country into chaos and displacing hundreds of thousands of people. But amid the violence, football offers a glimpse of hope to the country. So far, several South Sudanese players, including some who fled to Khartoum because of the conflict in the country, have returned to Juba to participate in the game. Lodule Lokulosara flew in from Germany for the game.
Our team is very prepared. We've been training for the last 10 days now or so, and everybody's very fit. We're adjusting and we're learning to play with each other very well. And the players are coming from a very high standard now. Some players coming from Khartoum, some players from USA, Australia, and myself from Germany. So we're very optimistic about our chances.
Duach Jok flew in from the U.S. to join the team.
I half grew up in the United States, so I came from the U.S., and that's why I'm playing my football trade professionally in the United States.
This is home. You know, home is where your heart is, and I'm more than glad and happy to be at home, just to represent the national team and represent the country and represent the people of South Sudan. And we have to have that individually in our hearts to want to come back home.
With 3 points, South Sudan is second in Group C behind Mali, who has 4 points. Benin and Equatorial Guinea trail behind South Sudan with 2 and 1 points respectively. South Sudan lost to Mali while away but beat Equatorial Guinea at home with 1-0. The Bright Stars have never qualified for the African Cup of Nations. A win today would be a small step towards that goal.
A rare positive story by Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Behind the headlines.
Zambia has made it more difficult for those wishing to contest for leadership positions, including the presidency, by setting minimum education requirements. The amended Zambian constitution now stipulates that candidates for councillorships and parliamentary seats must have completed at least a secondary education. However, this has caused panic among some political parties as they struggle to find suitable candidates. From Lusaka, Kathy Sikombe reports.
At Olympia Park High School in Lusaka, students from grades 8 to 12 are attending class. Since education in Zambia is not free, not all students will have the privilege of being educated up to grade 12. According to the Ministry of Education statistics, more than 60% of the population cannot read and write. It is no wonder that the new minimum education standards for those vying for public office have caused panic. Elizabeth Banda from the Opposition United Party for National Development is one of the affected aspiring councillors in Lusaka's Ngombe area. She did not complete her studies and only went up to grade 7.
I want to stand as a councillor, but why are they stopping us? I like the people in Ngombe. I can stand as an MP. I can do the work. I can do the job. But they are stopping me. I see it not good because they are just bringing people down who can be at that level.
Mwangala Mbangweta is the Secretary General for the Opposition Alliance for Democracy and Development, and she described the situation on the ground as very bad.
When it comes now to 2016 general elections, we're making quite a stride. But I think now on the ground, it's a bit shaky because of the checklist that we have been given by ECZ. Our candidates, the 12 certificate is affected our women folk. The 10,000, the 2,000 for councillors, and the 5,000 for the mayor or council chairman.
The ruling Patriotic Front Party has not been spared as it is also struggling to find suitable candidates. Mumbi Piri is the Deputy Secretary General of the Patriotic Front.
It's true, we are also affected with this grade 12 issue. It has affected all of us, but like yesterday I had a meeting in Chilanga. I'm glad that we have at least 5 women who are aspiring to be candidates as councillors, and they have 10 wards. So there, I'm sure we have a 50-50.
For Boniface Chembe, political analyst from the University of Zambia, the minimum academic qualifications will improve governance in Zambia.
This issue of grade 12 certificate in future may have to be revisited as long as we do not pass a bill of rights that compels the state to provide education. We may face problems in our country because not everyone in many different parts of the country may actually have that grade 12 certificate in order for them to vie as councillors and sometimes as MPs. And where you don't have people meeting such qualifications, then you begin to have problems in the governance process of the country.
For Evans Kunda from the Zambia National Women's Lobby, an NGO that promotes women's participation in politics, the education requirements will benefit the country in the long run.
It's something that we as an organization, Zambia National Women's Lobby, are looking at, something that is progressive. It's something that will actually push political parties to be able to source or look out tangible women that will be able to add value in terms of policy making and decision making within the political parties.
It is clear that Zambian voters are now expecting educated leaders who will fully represent them in public office. But the question remains as to how many eligible candidates will be found.
Kathy Sikombi reporting from Lusaka.
Listen to Africa Link whenever you want. Sign up for our podcast at dw.com/Africa Link Podcast.
Now, Congo-Brazzaville was one of the countries which had elections last weekend. Tensions have been running high in the country prior to the elections following the extension of term limits in October 2015 by the current president, Denis Sassou Nguesso. The atmosphere remains strained as citizens await the results of the elections. Here's a fact box about Congo-Brazzaville's longest-serving president, Sassou Nguesso, presented by John Oktoy Heisig and Ole Tangen Jr.
Born in 1943 to a peasant family in Edu, a small village in the north of Brazzaville, Sassou Nguesso received his early education at a teacher's college in Donisi, which is to the northwest of the country.
Between 1961 and 1963, he received military training in Algeria and France, and upon his return to Congo, he was appointed commander of the military forces in Brazzaville. By the early 1970s, he had risen to the rank of colonel.
Together with the third president of Congo-Brazzaville, Marien Ngouabi, he co-founded the Congolese Labour Party and was soon after nominated the Minister of Defense.
In 1979, Sassou Nguesso was installed by the military as the president of the Congolese Labour Party and president of Congo-Brazzaville. The country enjoyed relative political and economic stability under Sassou Nguesso's first term in office. He negotiated with the International Monetary Fund for the country to receive loans and allowed foreign investors from France and the US to carry out oil exploration and production.
Sassou Nguesso was re-elected in 1984 and again in 1989. In 1990, under pressure from the Confederation of the Congolese Unions, Sassou Nguesso abolished the one-party system and opened Congo-Brazzaville to a multi-party system. The first pluralistic presidential elections in 1992 saw Sassou Nguesso lose to Pascal Lissouba.
Tensions between President Pascal Lissouba and Sassou Nguesso escalated into a civil war shortly before the elections in 1997. Backed by Angola, Sassou Nguesso defeated Lissouba and seized power again.
In 2002, Sassou Nguesso was re-elected in an election that was clouded by controversy. Some opposition leaders boycotted the polls, claiming the elections were neither free nor fair.
His rule has been dogged by corruption allegations. In May 2009, a French judge announced an investigation into whether Sassou Nguesso and two other African leaders had plundered state coffers to purchase luxury homes and cars in France.
In 2015, a national referendum was organized by Sassou Nguesso to amend the constitution to allow the president to stand for his third term since returning to power in 1997. The move was boycotted by the opposition, who dubbed it a constitutional coup.
Preliminary results coming in today indicate that Sassou Nguesso is leading the presidential election results with 67.2% of the vote.
Johan Oktoy Heisig and Ole Tangen Jr. presented that fact box on Congo's president, Denis Sassou Nguesso.
Opinion.
For opinion this week, we go back to our top story. We've been reporting on the Brussels attacks that have left at least 30 people dead. We've also heard how enthusiastic South Sudanese football fans are hoping for a win ahead of their match with Benin this afternoon. We now ask, what do you think world leaders need to do to address the growing threat of Islamic terrorists? Not only in Brussels, but elsewhere in the world, like in Nigeria and Cameroon. And do you think that football in South Sudan can be used to restore peace in the war-torn country? Do send us your thoughts either by email to feedback.africa@dw.com, a letter to Africa Link, DW53110 Bonn, Germany, or an SMS to country code 49160957-59510, and we will read some of your comments right here on Africa Link.
For more about Africa Link, go to dw.com/Africa Link. Find out about Africa Link's partner stations. Send us your feedback in a text message and sign up for our newsletter, dw.com/Africa Link.
Now, according to official results released on Tuesday, Niger's President Mahamadou Issoufou reportedly secured 92% of the vote in a controversial runoff ballot boycotted by the opposition. His sole challenger, Hama Amadou, has been imprisoned since November on shadowy baby trafficking charges and was flown to France days before the second round for medical treatment. The vote was marred by low turnout and an opposition boycott. For more on this story, go to dw.com/Africa. And now a reminder of the stories that we've covered for you today. African leaders joined their European counterparts in condemning the Brussels attacks that left at least 30 people dead. South Sudan's national soccer team, the Bright Stars, are bracing for a showdown against Benin this afternoon in the capital, Juba. Zambia tightens the noose around those wishing to contest for local council positions by setting minimum education requirements. And just to remind you, in case you'd like to comment on the stories that we've covered, just send an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or an SMS to country code 49160957-59510. That's all we have for you today. I'm Isaac Mugabe in Bonn. We'll be right back.